Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be speaking first with Ian Williams, who writes about the United Nations, and we'll talk with him about the effect that the Gulf War II was going to have on the prospects for multilateralism. Then we'll talk to Blanche Lord, who's written her first novel in her 70s about becoming an author and writing utopian novels. I'm speaking with Ian Williams. Mr. Williams is a former speechwriter for the UK Labour leader Neil Kinnock. He's a widely published writer on the United Nations and global politics, and you can find links to his work at ianwilliams.info. Today I want to start by talking about your most recent article, Scarred and Battered, the UN Charts a Course in Post-War Iraq, which you published on March 21st, and I found it on a number of different lists. Where can people find it?
Oh, well, obviously, it's finding you. I think that one was Global Vision, which is gvnews.net. I am the deadline pundit, and I put these out every day. So far, I haven't had to repeat myself in ways of describing the ineptitude of this administration.
No, you're quite creative at describing the ineptitude. let's get to this. There was a wonderful frontline documentary on the other night about the origins of this war, and they basically pinned it on Paul Wolfowitz, that he was the author, the number two in the Pentagon, who wrote the foreign policy strategy paper back in 1992, which has more or less been adopted by the Bush administration. Do you adopt that view, or do you have a broader conspiracy in mind?
I think it is a conspiracy in one sense, but I don't think all of the conspirators are in the same conspiracy. I think it's a set of dogs chasing the same bone, and they've come at it from different ways. I don't think that Bush is inspired with the same neoconservative fervor of Wolfowitz and Pearl and his pals. And I'm not quite sure that Cheney's coming from that direction, but they share a lot of ground. There's the sort of evangelical fervor. The thing that's disturbing about this war right from the beginning has been the irrationality of the motivation for it.
There, speaking of Pearl, there's an article from The Guardian just a couple days ago, Thank God for the Death of the UN, written by Richard Pearl. And he attacks in particular Shirley Williams in the UK Parliament. This is an explicit goal of this administration, to destroy multilateral institutions, wouldn't you say?
Well, this is the problem again. It's not an explicit goal of this administration. Colin Powell and the State Department in many ways have been friendlier and better towards the United Nations than their democratic predecessors with Albright. But with this administration, I mean, what we get is multiple personality disorder on a global level. It's one of the reasons for the confusion over the last 6 months, that Colin Powell is doing and saying one thing, and behind the scenes you have the Pearls, the Wolfowitz, and the Rumsfeld rampaging around the world, undoing all of the good diplomatic work he may have tried to do. It really is confusing. But there's no doubt that these people have had it in for the United Nations all along, and this doesn't make any difference. It's always a good day to bash the United Nations and any other multilateral institution as far as they're concerned.
Now, this comes both from American conservative suspicions about the subordination of American national interests to a world government, as well as a vision of what a Pax Americana should be. Is that, don't you see this as the war that is to establish what a new Pax Americana should look like?
Yes, I think so. Certainly from the neocons, they and Wolfowitz, as you pointed out, that's the clear game plan they have. I think with some of them, it's just a case of paying back grudges against Iraq. I think with some of them, it's a way of protecting Israel. And some of them, it's all three rolled into one. But we can't look for too much coherence in this administration. You know, it sometimes looks as though it's some type of nefarious plot, when in fact it's multiple incompetencies coming together.
Well, if the divisions within the Bush administration are laid bare, the divisions within the British Labour Party administration is even more laid bare. Your article goes to some length to argue that Tony Blair, the pressure on Tony Blair's left flank has had an effect on the conduct of this war. Could you say that in general, that the anti-war movement and the United Nations has, it seems to have had quite an impact on the way this war is being conducted?
Certainly. I think in several ways. First of all, it's not just left-wing pressure, because for all of his faults, I think Tony Blair believes this as well. Even the conservatives in Britain think this. You know, the loony isolationism of American conservatives is, like so many, is unique to America. They've always thought the United Nations was an integral part. Sensibly, I think that Blair and Powell were actually working together to use the United Nations and multinational institutions to build up an alliance. And if they'd have had their way, if they'd have been given free rein, I suspect that the French and the others would have come round eventually and they would have got their war with international backing. It's the impatience and insouciance of the chicken hawks that have really brought this on. Remember, by the end in the United Nations, the issue wasn't really war or not war. It was whether you carried on with inspections for 30 to 45 days more and then had the war. That was basically what the French had come down to. And, in fact, if they hadn't been driven up a pole of principle by Rumsfeld and the others, they'd have probably come up with an accommodation like that much, much sooner. So, I mean, this is really what we're talking about here. The Bush administration, under pressure from the Wolfowitzes and Pearls, basically almost ripped up the United Nations Charter for a couple of weeks' difference in starting their war when they wanted it. What Tony Blair has done, and of course, people who oppose the war are not going to like it, but I suspect he's going to come out covered in glory, because he made his price, his very strong price to Bush at the Azores summit, was United Nations involvement as soon as possible. So despite what Pearl says, if Bush has a choice between getting rid of Richard Pearl and losing his only ally whose troops are dying, you know, in advance of the Americans in many cases, even as we speak, then he's not, despite the sort of notorious ingratitude of America, of Republicans, he's going to honor to some degree at least his promises to Blair. And that's what the State Department wants as well, that the UN will get involved, they'll come to some type of Kosovo-style agreement. And even more appallingly, I heard this week that the US has basically come to the United Nations and said, Congress hasn't appropriated any money, we don't have any money for relief operations, please hand over your relief funds to us now. That was basically what I heard they were telling the Secretariat on Friday. This is crazy. I mean, they've been told that one of the penalties of occupying a country without UN sanction is that you are an occupying power and you're responsible for feeding them, looking after them, educating them. Everything the Israelis aren't doing in the West Bank, you're supposed to do as an occupying power. And basically, the U.S. is already straining at the deficit, and without congressional approval, is trying to get the U.N. to do this for them, at least to pay for it, even as Pearl was writing.
Now, it goes without saying that this war will recast the structure of multilateral relations and the role of the U.N. Do you think that there's like a dialectical silver cloud here, that this will push nations that support a multilateral vision as opposed to Pax Americana to really rethink the democratic legitimacy, the structure, the Security Council, the funding, everything about the United Nations?
I don't think it's going to... Look, I always remind people, the last time we had a reform of a multinational institution, it took World War II, and I really think a root and branch reform of the United Nations will take World War III, and it's a high price to pay. There'll certainly be a close examination, and one of the key reasons that the United States is not going to walk out on the United Nations, Richard Pearl notwithstanding, is that if it did, then basically the United Nations would become not an anti-American alliance, but let's just say a non-American alliance. And this would give the neocons and the Pax Americana a real problem, because they want to control all these institutions, and to have a major institution with huge prestige internationally that they don't even have a say in would be far, far too much for them. So the U.S. is going to stay involved in the United Nations, and the United Nations is going to carry on pretty much as before, except, of course, there are some seismic changes in the global politics. I think this is really the first time since the end of the Cold War that we really have seen the emergence of not necessarily an opposition, but a counterbalance to the United States. China was extremely outspoken. Russia was extremely outspoken. Of course, we know about the French and the Germans. And in the end, I think where the French and Germans are going, a lot of Europe, Blair notwithstanding, will be going. Because the key test now, I think, for Blair and his credibility is going to be not so much whether the Bush delivers on the UN, which I think he will, but whether Bush delivers anything at all on the roadmap in the Middle East, which was the other part of the promise he extracted in the Azores. And I think that's a much more dubious issue because if you remember, within 3 days, it was announced in Israel that Condoleezza Rice had approved $10 billion in loan guarantees for Ariel Sharon, which is basically to pay him for what the rest of the world regards as illegal behavior in the occupied territories. If you remember, Bush Sr. refused $10 billion loan guarantees for the previous set of Likudniks until they stopped building settlements. This Bush has given a roadmap that Sharon has already threatened to amend out of all sort of semblance of its original form, and given him $10 billion as a bribe to carry on defying it. It does not bode well for the Middle East peace process, which is most of the rest of the world has been tying into the Iraq issue. And if this administration thinks Iraq is a quick fix for terrorism, which some in the wilder dreams they may do, I think they're about to be wildly disabused.
The EU in their summit this week was supposed to be discussing the creation of a common foreign minister. And, of course, the divisions within the European Union have laid bare the difficulties of that. But don't you think it also makes it clear in the long run of the need for a standing European-controlled military force and a common foreign policy?
I think that's they've got to do some serious thinking. I mean, the key element that's been missing in a common European force has been the heavy lift capacity. And the Europeans, quite sensibly and understandably, have been taking this peace dividend thing seriously, unlike the Americans, since the end of the Cold War, and they've been cutting back on military expenditure. So Germany only recently drastically cut back its orders for heavy transport aircraft. And that's really why the US has been indispensable, even for peacekeeping operations, because they haven't had the ability to airlift rapid amounts of personnel in a short time. I do think they'll be thinking a lot more strongly about it from now on. And intriguingly, of course, that Britain is actually involved in that process as well. So we're not quite sure. Britain might prove a sort of two-way Trojan horse by the time it finishes.
Let me throw my last question at you, which has to do with the nature of this alleged anti-war movement. I know that you share some of the critical thoughts that I have about the many different factions and tendencies within what goes for an anti-war movement in the 1990s and recent years. And do you think that this response to this war is turning in the direction that actually supports multilateralism, or is it really the same dead end of anti-Americanism as a political ideology?
It's difficult to characterize. I think the anti-war movement this time has been much, much more mature than the previous ones, which is one of the reasons why it was much, much bigger. It hasn't been anti-American. It's evoked, you know, core American values of democracy and rule of law as against the lawlessness of the administration. I have not heard anybody, apart from, you know, the usual suspects, Ramsey Clark and co., in any way condoning or defending Saddam Hussein. I think most of the peace protesters would agree that he is an evil person and the world is better off without him. Nobody's shouting victory to the Ba'athist Party on the streets of New York that I've heard. So there's a maturity there, but the real difficulty is when I heard speakers, for example, at the Socialist Scholars Conference last weekend, saying that whether or not the United Nations approved that this war was wrong and illegal. And this is wishful thinking. It might be immoral, but it's still legal if the United Nations approved it. And Saddam Hussein was posing a problem with defiance. And yes, you can point to all the other people who are defying. And the thing is that by saying that you can't take any action on one, in a way you're saying you can't take any action on the others. And what we should have been doing is saying, well, yes, okay, if you're going to do this, where are you going to try Saddam Hussein? Tony Blair on Thursday in Parliament this week was talking about getting him tried at the International Criminal Court. And I'd love to hear what John Bolton and the lunatics in the Pentagon think about that, since they've spent the last year trying to cripple that very body. Will John Ashcroft be allowed to drag people off to Guantanamo Bay to the dismay of the world? Interesting question. Will the U.S. be able to get away with trying to impose some type of neo-colonial government there, or will it have at least a cover of a UN flag on it, which is what the rest of the world is saying? And we get down to sort of pragmatic stuff here. The United States does not want to pay for this occupation. It wants the United Nations in there to pay for reconstruction. It wants the Oil for Food program under United Nations auspices to carry on feeding people because it doesn't want to. In the end, it's going to find that I think the French were signaling that they would take quite a hard line, that of course they support reconstruction, but they didn't believe that international money should be pumped into what would be an American neo-colony. You can look at this selfish, of course, because there is Total Elf Aquitaine that does have contracts there, and Lukoil has contracts. But there will be some hard bargaining. It's difficult for people who've just signed a load of contracts with Halliburton and so on to point to the French for self-interest on these matters. But there is a global interest here, and that is that I'm sure the State Department will be arguing that the only way to legalize any post-war administration is through the United Nations, because the United Nations is the only body that can sort of kosher a modern nation-state or an occupation. It's whether Richard Perle and his pals like it or not, it is the body that's respected by most of the world. Because of it, it can legitimate things.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Ian. You can find more of Ian Williams' work at alternet.org, salon.com, or from links on his website at ianwilliams.info.
Okay, thanks.
I'm speaking now with Blanche F. Lord. Ms. Lord is a former reporter for the Gannett Chain newspapers. Then she worked in public relations, and then after retirement, she decided to try her hand at the writing of fiction and wrote her first novel, Cloud of Chaos, Planet of Light, which is a utopian novel. And you can find Ms. Lord's work at bflord.com. Why did you decide to take up writing at such a late stage in your life? I've tried to write a little bit of a science fiction novel myself, and most of the writers that I've talked to counsel that if you haven't started writing by the time you're 15 and passionately been writing all your life, that it's very difficult to find any kind of satisfaction in this endeavor.
Well, I had written for a long time, and I had written quite a long memoir, which I never finished and never published. What really stimulated me was I took a writing workshop with Stuart O'Mann at Trinity College, and it was fiction writing, and he just inspired me. And afterwards, it was right after that I really decided to get a new computer and to start writing a book.
Now, your book is a utopian novel, which is a genre that most people in science fiction shy away from nowadays. What inspired you to write specifically a utopian tract?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I think I was inspired by three major things in my life, if we have time for me to go into it a little bit.
Sure.
I had the earliest inspiration that came to me was from my association with my first husband and his university friends in Philadelphia. And that was in the mid-1940s. And they thought of themselves as radical democratic socialists. As far as I was concerned, I was studying voice and hoping to become a concert singer. But we both had a lot of radicals, so-called radicals, came to our home in the center of Philly. And we spent a lot of time discussing socialism. We were very anti-Stalinist. We talked about the Kerensky government, the socialist government in Germany that was annihilated by Hitler, and, of course, the Jewish persecution. And mainly, they gave me loads of books to read. So I was exposed at that time to the concept that mankind is potentially capable of building a better world. And that was a big inspiration. The second, and perhaps the most important inspiration of my life, was when I became a Baha'i, member of the Baha'i faith in the 70s. As a former Jewish agnostic, the Baha'i faith appealed to me several ways. It not only appealed to me because of its spiritual teachings, but also because it is in the process of building a model worldwide society based on the principle of love for one's fellow man. It talks about peace, acceptance of all religions, elimination of prejudice, equality of men and women, to name a few of the principles. Anyway, the third was the most entertaining reason, I guess. I was a fan, and I'm still a fan, of the Star Trek series. I was particularly intrigued by the Federation, which I thought brought the diverse civilizations and faraway planets under one authority. I guess something like a United Nations in space. Their understanding of the differing needs of unique civilizations and their principles of not interfering with them, except to improve their knowledge and quality of life, that's the kind of thing that fit right into my ideas of a future universal world.
You describe your society as social democratic in the abstract, the blurb about your the novel, but yet you don't really think of yourself as a socialist anymore, but you still think that the possibility of having an egalitarian society is important as a part of your utopian project.
Well, egalitarian is a very curious word, because I guess in my society, people were rewarded in terms of their abilities and their accomplishments. So it's not the communist idea that, you know, you get...
to each according to their need. You had to each according to their work.
Right.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
A bit different.
Right.
So
let me also ask about, you have in your dialogue the Marius.
Marius, I call it.
Marius, okay. Your novel has the structure of an Earth man being contacted by a distant civilization that is very advanced and utopian, that are trying to save us from a coming calamity. And the man travels to the society, learns about its advantages, and then is unable to convince Earth people of taking precautionary measures, and we get wiped out.
I didn't want you to give that away.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, but that's actually interesting, because H.G. Wells and a whole swath of utopian writers used to have that kind of a structure of the close connection between apocalypse and utopian project.
Mm-hmm.
But the people from Marius describe themselves as God-fearing. Which I thought was kind of archaic sound to it, but now that I understand that you're a Baha'i, is that a part of your understanding of what it would take to have a utopian society, that people would have to be God-fearing? Most science fiction is kind of secular humanist, like Star Trek.
Right. Well, if you look in the humanist literature, you also have this kind of vision, so that I don't think it's only a religious vision. I mean, our great humanitarian philosophers certainly talked about creating a better world here. And what was the rest of that question?
Well, it struck me that it's rare to find a science fiction novel where the protagonists, or any protagonist, would describe themselves as God-fearing, except in a kind of ironic kind of way.
Well, actually, my Earthling people are not particularly one way or the other. They don't identify themselves with this at all. It's only in the planet Marius that they have that they are God fearing, and they think of a one God, a universal God.
Does Baha'i, the teachings of Baha'u'llah, does he emphasize the fear of God? Is that a concept in Baha'i?
Well, that's not the major thing. It's not so much fear, and I don't know exactly where you get that from.
Well, there's a section here in Chapter 11 where the character Eam says, "We are a God-fearing people."
Oh, yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that in the Baha'i faith, God is omnipotent, and God is not only the creator, but he has control of everything. He is the all-powerful, and humanity is dependent upon him. So in that sense, they're God-fearing, yes. But in the but still, there is a strong belief in free will and in our own making of our world, so that we as individuals are responsible for what we do and how we forge our life.
I don't want to get too far into the theological discussion. And now your third inspiration, the Star Trek, you mentioned in particular the idea of a federalism, of world federalism, that the Federation kind of represents. And we're in a crisis right now internationally where the Bush administration has very consciously and explicitly said that the United Nations should be put on the dustbin of history, is irrelevant to the creation of world peace, and is engaging in a unilateral war, or more or less unilateral war with 45 fictitious allies. What do you think about this war? What do you think about the prospect of world government? But we'll speak for the people of Marias as well.
The people of Marias, I believe, would have been very much in favor of the United Nations. And in fact, in my novel, they have the United Nations is the one body that believes what they say.
So they try to prevent the destruction from the coming cloud.
Right, and they are trying. What they do is they're trying to convince the president of the danger, and the president of the United States. Now, yeah, I want to make clear that I wrote this before 9/11, so it would have taken maybe a whole different shape had that happened, but. The Marias, well, believe very much in a unified government, although there was a grassroots element in there where people governed themselves. Everybody was elected. In the Baha'i faith, there are no priests or ministers or anybody who is over anybody else. It's just a question of service, so that if you are elected by the people, you serve the people. So it is a different concept.
I'm speaking with Blanche F. Lord. She's the author of the utopian novel Cloud of Chaos, Planet of Light. You can find her and her work at bflord.com. And you're working on another novel, right? Chasing Cobwebs, isn't it?
I have finished another novel quite different from this one. It's not a science fiction. It's about an American family.
Is it based on your family? Or?
No. The wonderful part about all of this is nothing is based on my family. It is pure fiction. And it's wonderful to me that at this late stage of my life, I've been able to write fiction.
And I hope that you have many years of successful writing ahead of you.
Well, I'm very happy because it's very gratifying to me to be able to get a few of my points across, since my children and grandchildren don't listen to me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.